Stats can be hard to understand, but this one isn't. Nearly 1 in 4 people can't afford food in Canada. What does food insecurity look like where you live? Look up your address at foodsecuritynow.ca. That's foodsecuritynow.ca. Join Community Food Centers Canada in making a difference today.
All I can get is static or variations on the central musical rhythm.
I only wish there was some way we could tell it to shut up. It's driving me crazy. And it keeps getting louder.
We have no way of estimating the volume this creature can produce.
The only logical solution is to listen to CJSF 90.1 FM. They broadcast from Burnaby Mountain in British Columbia. Let's tune in now.
It is only through a change in human consciousness that the world will be transformed. The personal and the planetary are connected. As we expand our awareness of mind, body, psyche, and spirit, and bring that awareness actively into the world, so also will the world be changed. This is our quest as we explore new dimensions.
Medical aid in dying is a relatively recent development in the United States. First legalized in Oregon in 1997, it allowed physicians to prescribe life-ending medications to terminally ill patients who may take them at a time of their own choosing. Since then, this option has expanded to 10 states plus Washington, D.C., now encompassing roughly 22% of the U.S. population. It's essential to understand what is involved in making one of the most profound and complex decisions a person may ever face, including knowing one's legal rights, the kinds of support available, navigating conversations with family and friends, and finding physicians willing and able to participate. So today, we will explore these concerns and more with Dr. Lonnie Shavelson, whose work has long been rooted in close-up encounters with crises, vulnerability, and the ethics of care. Dr. Lonnie Shavelson is a California physician, best known as a national leader in the medical aid in dying for terminally ill patients. Dr. Shavelson worked for nearly 3 decades as an emergency department physician in Berkeley, California, and later served as primary care doctor in a clinic for immigrants and refugees. He's a founder and board chair of the Academy of Medical Aid in Dying, where he helps develop best practices, clinician education, and policy in this emerging field. He has also consulted widely with hospitals' ethics committees and state efforts to implement aid in dying laws. He's the author of A Chosen Death and Medical Aid in Dying, A Guide for Patients and Their Supporters. So please join us for the next hour as we explore the issues of end-of-life care, including medical aid in dying, with our guest, Dr. Lonnie Shavelson. I'm speaking with Dr. Shavelson at his home by remote connection. I'm Justine Willis-Toms. I'll be your host. Welcome to New Dimensions. Dr. Shavelson, welcome.
Happy to be here. Thanks for inviting me.
Oh, thank you. It's my honor to have you here. You were introduced very early as a teenager with the issue of the right to die. Your mother suffered from suicidal wishes and severe depression. So how did this influence you to become a physician later on?
Yeah, it's a good place to start, I suppose. I was around 12 years old. My mom had a severe Crohn's disease, which is now called ulcerative colitis or regional enteritis, but an inflammatory bowel disease. She was quite ill. She was not terminally ill, however. But because she was quite ill, and that probably led to her depression, or it may have been independent, who knows. But the combination of that made her quite suicidal for a long, long time. When I was 12, she asked me to help her die. And we did that dance until she was, 75, when she did die of completely of other causes. In my home, when I was young, we had kitchen table discussions about suicide and death as a result of disease and death as a result of hastening death because of the disease. We didn't talk about depression because we really didn't recognize it back then. But I grew up thinking that every family talks about death this way. You just don't know what the comparison is. And so for me, it was something that I wanted to get more involved in and to understand better, because we were doing that dance in my family. What's very important to me about that is that I'm totally comfortable with talking about death. I grew up with it. I only learned later that everybody doesn't sit around the table talking about that. But there you have it. And so for me, it's very natural. And I think my patients feel that no secrets here. This is what's happening. And I'm very open and honest and very truthful.
As you say, it's a taboo subject in many families, and even today it's hard to talk about. Let's just talk about end-of-life option, and just exactly what is it?
Yeah, so a mistake that's commonly made, and I was pleased to hear you do the same. So there we are. There we have the stigma, right? It's not about doctors prescribing a medication. That's sort of like saying that the treatment of cancer is about doctors prescribing chemotherapy only. This is about doctors providing end-of-life care, good end-of-life care, which may include the option for some of taking medications to die. The first myth to dispel here is that when somebody says there's a new right that doctors can write prescriptions for medications to help you die. That's true, but that's just the minimum. What we do is we take care of patients who are dying. We provide options. We talk about everything from hospice to even continued aggressive care of your underlying disease. We talk about laying out the options. The new thing is that we also have the option of working with you to make a decision or not to take medications to hasten your death as you get usually really close to death. So it's not about prescription writing. It's about care for patients.
Well, that's really an important point, because what you talk about and convey to us in your whole practice is to work with the emotional more than just the physical, but the emotional care or the spiritual care, just the idea of having prelim conversations with people. So talk about those preliminary conversations you would have with a client or with a patient.
Sure. Here's the guiding principle. When a patient comes to me and says, I want aid in dying, my first response is, thank you for considering aid in dying. Because from the very first moment, it's an option to consider. It's not a decision that you make easily and just say that, oh, I haven't talked to anybody really about this yet. You're the aid in dying doctor. I want to do aid in dying. And I try to move that back to, okay, tell me why. And what's up? And tell me about your illness. And I've already reviewed charts in great detail, and I know about the patient. And it's really about, let's talk about your specific illness. Let's have the conversation that is almost never had, which is, I call the how you die conversation, which is, here's what your death is likely to look like. Likely, there are variations, but you know, we kind of have a sense of things over time. Here's what it may look like. Tell me what your limits are, what you think about that picture I just drew. Let's talk about it. And sometimes patients will tell me something like, I watched my mom die of the same cancer that I have, and I don't want to die like that. She was in severe pain and miserable. And I'll say something like, when was that? And they say, 40 years ago. Well, you know, medicine has changed in 40 years in a lot of ways. We have better hospices. We have better pain medications. We have better ideas of how to treat symptoms, manage symptoms. And so first thing I will say is your death will not look like your mother's death, whether you do medical aid in dying or not. What are you really afraid of? What did you see? Well, my mom's pain was out of control. Well, let's get you into hospice and palliative care and treat your pain. And along the way, I'm not denying you aid in dying by saying, no, you have to do this first. I'm just saying, here's what we can do to help you. There are many options along the way. You don't have to decide right now whether you want medical aid in dying. What we're going to do is we're going to fulfill the legal requirements within the first couple of weeks. So I know that you are what I call eligible. Once you have eligibility, sit back, relax. You know, I have your back. If you should have a hard time during your death and decide that, yes, you know, this is getting too hard. I have 2 weeks to live, and those are going to be very hard weeks. I'm not going to gain much by those 2 weeks. Can you give me the medications to die? And I say, not only give them to you, I'll be there with you. And then we move forward. But also, it may be that they keep on going towards their death and towards their death and towards their death, and they're doing okay, and they just keep on dying, and then they die, and I'm as happy about that as if they ask for medications to die. Our goal is to provide them with the death that they consider to be their best death, and we can do that by a variety of routes. So nobody comes to me asking for aid in dying, and I just say, sure, let's qualify you, here's the prescription. It's a process.
And when you say it's a process, maybe somebody will come to you and say, I definitely will want this option. Have you had the experience of someone changing their mind, let's say, last minute?
Yeah, all the time. What's wrong with that expression, changing their mind, is presuming that they had a fixed idea of what it would be. So my first goal is to get, you know, really talk people out of the fixed idea. And the expression is, you only die once, you haven't done it yet, you don't know what it's like. So it's kind of like saying that, you know, you want some future car or something like that. You just don't know what the roads are going to be like. And you can't decide. So, you know, some people say that, you know, I've thought about this for all of my life. And I will still say, well, but you haven't died yet. And this is your one chance to see what that's like. And if you keep on going and you want medical aid in dying, and I, you know, will work with you about how do you pick a date? I mean, there are complicated things like when, you know, it's the how, when, where question. And there are so many questions along the way that I do my best to keep this as an open decision. So do they change their mind? I don't know. I'm not sure what their mind actually was made up to do. But if it was made up to do, and let's say that we say on Sunday, my family will gather and I'm going to take medications to die. It's pretty rare at that point in time that somebody changes their mind, but they do. A couple that I worked with, two women who wanted, you know, I was about to leave the house to come to their house to help one of them die who had severe breast cancer, metastatic all over, but was still, you know, basically able to walk a little bit. And they decided they wanted one more day on their beach, which is pretty nearby. And I said, fine. Let's call it off and I'll come another day, or I won't come at all, depending on what you decide after your walk on the beach. I make it very, very clear that all decisions are open to revision. You learn as you go. I have never had a patient, and it's as rare as it can possibly be, that on the day they're choosing to take the medications, that I arrive, I tell them they can change their mind at any time up to the moment they have these medicines in their mouth. It's very rare that somebody changes their mind. I've been stunned. I've been doing this for 9 years now, at the fact of how brave people are at that last moment. I always expect deep hesitation. I'm not sure and all that. Boy, by the time we get to that point, they are firm in their decision and ready, and not ready to die. You know, nobody's really ready to die. And I want to dispel the myth of suicide, if I may, for a moment. This is not assisted suicide. They would love to live on. They want to live, but their disease is not allowing that. So the choice is, you know, you're going to die in the next couple of weeks. How do you want to die? Not if you will die. Suicide, on the other hand, is, well, you do have the choice to live on. You may opt out of that, and maybe choice is wrong depending on how you define it in mental illness. But nonetheless, in suicide, you can live on. And we don't do that. We don't participate in suicides if the patient has the ability to live on. And so if someone comes to me and says, I'm severely ill, or I have a severe disability, or whatever it may be that people are afraid we abuse in the medical aid in dying world, the answer is no. If you are not terminally ill with a fairly well-defined less than 6 month prognosis to live, and especially in my experience, most people are really very, very close to death, and it's an inevitable death, what we call inevitable and non-reversible. So when somebody has an inevitable and non-reversible death, they're not doing suicide. They don't have the option to live. It's not possible. At that point in time, when it's really close, we don't see people changing their mind, although legally, ethically, and in my personal ethics, somebody can change their mind, and I make it very clear up until the last minute when they are about to swallow those meds, if they want to say no, I will not in any way feel badly about that. There's no pressure from anyone. Their family will say, great, you know, let's do death another way. And I also don't walk out and say, okay, that's not my part anymore. If they decide not to take the medications, I'm still there. I'm still their doctor. This is about end-of-life care with that as a particular option. I still am their end-of-life doctor.
And when you say that, I know that you said it's not about suicide. It's and even on the death certificate, they don't list suicide.
So there's a legal part of that. All of the laws that have been written so far say that on the death certificate, the cause of death, lung cancer, ALS, whatever it may be, the cause of death is written on the death certificate. The reason for that is privacy. Death certificates are open to the public. So let's say that you did a medical aid in dying and your uncle is severely opposed to that and the family hasn't told him and doesn't want to tell him. Well, he can't look at the death certificate and find out your secret that you did that with the rest of your family and the uncle was excluded. I don't recommend that for what it's worth. Family secrets don't last very long. So uncle's going to find out anyways. But nonetheless, there's an element of privacy that was very important in writing these laws. Some people say that that doesn't allow us to follow medical aid in dying because it's not written on the death certificate. There are other ways that we follow this. There's data that comes into the states. It's anonymized. But on your personal death certificate, you have the right to not have this listed for privacy reasons.
Okay, that's good to know. When you mentioned something earlier about when we're talking about end-of-life care, you're talking about palliative care and hospice care. What is the difference between those two?
Palliative care is the general treatment of symptoms, not necessarily the underlying disease. So if you have severe pain, they don't say, well, is it, you know, I'm going to treat your cancer? Although they can and others can, but it's mostly, I'm going to treat your pain. If you have severe nausea, I'm going to treat your nausea. If you're severely depressed, we're going to work on your depression. They treat symptoms. So that's the general larger field of palliative care. It can apply to people who are not dying. It can apply to people who are severely disabled or people who just have severe illness or whatever it may be. Palliative care is the broadest term. Hospice care, on the other hand, is just for people who are dying. By law, by Medicare law, they have to have the same as we do for medical aid in dying. You have to have a prognosis of less than 6 months to live to get into hospice. Hospice care is not a place, that's important to know. It's something that happens most commonly in people's homes. Yes, there are sometimes residential hospices, but most people make this mistake of saying, I don't want to go into hospice, I want to stay at home. That's exactly how it works. But hospice incorporates palliative care into the treatment of symptoms as you get close to death. So they're similar, but otherwise unique. In the realm of medical aid in dying, it's important to know that some 95% patients reported to states about this who do medical aid in dying, who complete medical aid in dying, have also been receiving hospice care. So somebody doesn't say, I don't want hospice, I want medical aid in dying, or I'm in hospice and I can't have medical aid in dying. Not true. You can do them both simultaneously. In fact, that's the most common thing that happens because we highly recommend it. I want all of my patients who are considering aid in dying. Remember, that's the state of the art term. You are considering aid in dying. If you are considering aid in dying, I want to make sure that you're getting the best end-of-life care you can possibly get so that you're not considering aid in dying and completing it because of lousy medical care. I want you to be doing it because you're getting the best medical care that you can at the end of life, and that's still your choice. And so if medical aid in dying is your choice, I really want those patients to be getting hospice care because that's the way that I know that they're getting the best end-of-life care.
What happens when the family of a person who is considering aid in dying objects and they don't want it and there are strong objections? How do you handle that?
Mostly I stay away from the issue. I know that sounds coarse, but I'll explain. When families have disagreements, this is not their first rodeo when they talk about a disagreement about medical aid and dying. Mostly, families have had various disagreements over the lifetime of their family, and I just say, look, you guys have worked things out like this before. It's a tough, tough decision. You made a decision about stopping chemotherapy, or you made a decision if you have ALS about being on a ventilator. I'm here if you need me. We have chaplains with hospice. We have social workers. We have therapists with hospice if you need them. But mostly, work it out the best you can. We're here if you need help. 95% of the time, they work it out all on their own. They figure it out. Mostly, the resolution, by the way, is that families say, look, mom wants to die this way, or dad wants to die this way, or whatever it may be, or your brother or your sister. We don't agree, but it's their decision. You know, most families come to this idea of personal choice. They've dealt with that all their lives. Or the most common thing I hear is, my brother's the most stubborn person I ever knew. We're not going to be able to stop him anyways. We'll have to just support him, even though we're opposed. So when I step back, most families just really come to their own way. They work this through. When they don't, the final decision is the patient's, unequivocally. If there's a decision and families say, no, we don't want this, I will work it out as much as I can with the family and then say, my final obligation is to my patient. If that's a well-thought-out decision and all the requirements have been fulfilled and they've got the best palliative and end-of-life care they can, I'm going to support the patient and I'll do my best to bring in as much of the family as I can. But it's the patient who makes the decision.
When there is a religious precept that the dignity of life, we should not interfere with it at all. How have you personally coped with this idea?
What I tell patients, and this is what's most important, if you have a spiritual guide, talk with them about this. If it's your priest, talk with your priest about that. Whoever you've been using to guide your own personal spirituality, that's yours, not mine. And I will respect that. And then if they want to ask me about a framework like how I see it, I'll be open about that. One of the questions is, for example, the redemptive value of suffering. That is used a lot in varied religions, which says that by not allowing the patient to go down the path of full suffering, they are not having the redemptive value at the end of the life, at the end of their life. I'm fine with that. But then I ask the patient, do you find that you're getting any redemptive value in this aspect of your suffering? Have you talked with your spiritual guide about that? And if you're not finding that redemptive value, and then you have to decide, well, if it's against your religious tenets to not do it, what's important to you, following the religious tenets or going with what you decide is the redemptive value of your personal death? Remember, every death is individual. And we can't make generalizations. And so I kind of cop out on the question of religion and just say, look, it's still a personal decision. Talk with your spiritual guides. I'll give you some opinions along the way of what I'm thinking about, how this is playing out for you personally. And then you get to make a decision. Let me paint the picture, if I may. One of the most moving deaths I've ever been at was in the Central Valley in California, a farm worker community, a Latino family of 10 children. And their father had severe colon cancer and was having a very difficult time with it. Very Catholic, you know, every Sunday at church, Catholic church. Priest knew that family really, really, really well. Dad says probably 2 weeks before he was dying that this is just not helping me. I'm not learning anything. I'm miserable. And the palliative care is working, my pain control is good and all that, but all I do now is lay in this bed and have somebody clean me up. And that, you know, that can be dignified, by the way. Families can get into that. I'm not denigrating the idea of families cleaning up, but that's up to the patient too, how they feel about it. So this particular person was quite miserable, called me and explained the situation, and every one of his 10 children and his priest was against it. So it's 10 against one. Again, families work these things through. Same expression. Dad's always been stubborn. He does what he wants. We're going to tell him what we think, and he's going to do what he wants anyways. When I arrived for his death day, I walked in the door as the priest was leaving. Priest And he was literally minutes from taking medications to die. Priest had come, said the last rites, in the end respected the patient's decision, did not abuse him or punish him or castigate him, came, administered the last rites as the family and the patient wanted. I was walking in, the priest was walking out, he shook my hand, and we left and I walked in for my part. The patient took the medications, rapidly entered into a coma. As he was comatose, it was taking about an hour or so for him to die. The family all was gathered around reciting the rosary in Spanish after a medical aid and dying death. That was the most beautiful combination of philosophy, independent decision-making, religion, spirituality. It all came together in that room in tears, in storytelling, in the rosary recitation, and singing together. And then their father died. And as I left, everyone in the family hugged me and said, thank you for doing what he wanted to do. The one person who didn't feel that way turned his back to me and just wouldn't acknowledge me at all. And I thought, well, that's fine too. You know, we all deal with this as the way we deal with it. No hard feelings, no feeling insulted. I don't have any personal gain in the way these deaths happen. But that's your answer about spirituality.
I'm wondering, Ed, in that moment, as you're describing it, it's hard for any one of us to be fully prepared for the finality of death. So we've been with this person, we've been through this, let's say our loved one, through this whole process of illness and their decline and then they're wanting to have aid in dying. And now they've died and suddenly here we are with that finality. So we're left for the first time with a full dose of grieving, so to speak. Well, what can you say about that?
Sure. Let's dispel another myth. Aid in dying deaths are deaths. Deaths are deaths. All deaths are deaths. Deaths from surprise of car trauma is a death. Death from a long-term illness. The patient dies. It's traumatic. It brings on tremendous amounts of grief in a variety of ways, very individual for each individual. I have not experienced that aid in dying deaths are any different than that. In fact, one could argue, and I think my experience backs it up, is that having open discussions about the death, the timing, the person's wishes, these are in some ways deaths that are less traumatic. They are not surprises. They don't have long periods of undesired suffering. And so in comparing aid in dying deaths to other deaths, well, we haven't ended death. When somebody says, oh, they had such a lovely death, it's not like they don't mourn. Right. And they say they had such a lovely death, whether it was aid in dying or hospice or whether it was just whatever happens. So aid in dying deaths are like all deaths. They bring on grief. They're traumatic. They're sad. But someone just died. And we always keep that in mind.
I want to remind our listeners that I'm here with Dr. Lonnie Shaverson. He is the author of A Chosen Death and Medical Aid in Dying, A Guide for Patients and Their Supporters. If you want to know more about his work, you can go to his website, his organizational website, aadm.org. And that stands for Academy of Aid in Dying Medicine. That's aadm.org. Or you can get there through the New Dimensions website, newdimensions.org, where you'll find more than 2,000 programs in our archive. I'm Justine Willis-Toms. You're listening to New Dimensions.
New Dimensions is brought to you by Friends of New Dimensions membership support and by Clarity International, publisher of the book Get Clarity, The Lights On Guide to Manifesting Success in Life and Work. GetClarity.com. New Dimensions and our quarter-hour New Dimensions Cafe programs are now available worldwide as podcasts. You can find them at the iTunes Store and on many podcast sites and mobile apps. NewDimensions.org.
I'm here with Dr. Lonnie Shaverson, and we're talking about end-of-life care and the possibility of considering aid in dying. Those groups of people that are very vulnerable. You've worked with immigrants, you've worked with refugees, you've worked with many, many families. And for those, let's